fake it until you make it, or so the saying goes. Has there been a time, though, when you felt like you're still faking it, even though you've apparently made it, or at least achieved a lot in your chosen profession? Despite all evidence to the contrary, you might have been promoted, you might have received lots of great feedback about your work. The proof is there that you're good at what you do, and yet you still have that nagging feeling that any moment now someone is going to expose you as a fraud, as a novice, or totally out of your depth. Is there a voice inside your head that sometimes says, you don't deserve this, you really shouldn't be here? Scratch the surface, as it turns out, of many accomplished, seemingly successful people, and you'll discover what some are calling the imposter syndrome. And we're taking your calls on this first up this morning, loving your comments on our Facebook page about this very feeling. Have you had this feeling? Have you seen it in others? What do you think causes it? And what impact can it have on your sense of self and your ability to achieve at what you do? Has the feeling perhaps subsided over time? Give us a call. Get cracking. 1300 22 55 76, or 1300-CALL-RN. The imposter syndrome. Your boss says, I want you to do this job, you're the right person for it, and somehow you feel you must have said something or acted in a way that gives an impression that you're more capable than you actually are. 1300 22 55 76, or you can text us 0418 226 576. If you're in WA, Northern Territory or South Australia, your best bet might be to ring our listener line 0283 1430, or get on our Facebook page. You can tweet us too at RN Life Matters. Now, to kick us off this morning, I'm joined by Hugh Cairns. He runs workshops and has lectured on this very subject in universities across Australia and internationally. He's talking to academics this week about this very feeling. It's not uncommon in the academic arena, I gather. He's a co-director of ThinkWell, a psychology and educational consultancy, and a lecturer and researcher at Flinders University in South Australia. Welcome, Hugh.
Good morning, Natasha.
What sparked your interest in this idea of imposter syndrome? Surprisingly common, I think, as a feeling.
Yes, it is surprisingly common. My interest, I suppose, started in my role. I travel around Australia to the top universities around Australia and around the world, working with really high-achieving researchers or academics and looking at how they can be more effective at what they do. And so you're working with these very bright people who have achieved a lot, and yet when you talk to them and you spend a bit of time, they suddenly say things like, but I don't think I can do this, I'm not able to do this, I'm not clever enough, I can't manage these things. And yet there's clear evidence that they can, but they have this very strong feeling that this isn't right. There's somehow they've been they got in by mistake, or at any moment someone's going to tap them on the shoulder and say you shouldn't be here. Yeah. So there's this contrast, this paradox here. The evidence says you can, but you have that very strong feeling, and it's not just false modesty or anything. It's a genuine feeling, and so that sparked my interest in looking at that concept and the background behind it.
Isn't a degree of self-doubt though useful? Healthy, perhaps? I mean, we don't want to all be kind of narcissists about our achievements.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's, I suppose, the research I'm looking at is to say that some degree of what I would call imposter feeling, or that sort of little question when somebody does ask you to do a new job, when you have that initial thing, maybe I can't do it, well, that's actually a reasonable thought. But then what you have to do is go and look at the evidence and say, well, hang on, I have done this before, or I have the experience or ability to do it, or I can't be perfect on my first go. So that would be quite normal, but then what happens is people go, but hang on, the feeling is so strong, maybe it's true. And so it morphs from that sort of imposter feeling into an imposter syndrome when you start to believe these things and then start to act and behave in a way that sort of follows it through. So, yeah, a little bit of doubt is very normal, but then for some people that gets a bit out of control.
They can really hijack their own capacity to perform. Does it go hand in hand, Hugh, with people who have high expectations of themselves, with perfectionists?
Yes, I think that there certainly are some links and correlations between, a lot of it is around about your view of expectations, what is an acceptable level. And for some people, the acceptable level is things need to be perfect. And in particular, what's more related to it is about mistakes. If you view mistakes as bad, if they're sort of a final judgment on you, then it becomes really scary, because it, not only is it bad to make a mistake, but then they're going to find out that also you actually can't do anything. It's not that you can't do this one thing, but suddenly your whole facade will be exposed. So that's really where it becomes a problem, and that's where mistakes in particular cause people a lot of anxiety and worry about the whole area.
Mm. I gather the term imposter syndrome was first used by US psychologist Pauline Clance and Susan Imes back in the 70s, late 70s, when interviewing a number of highly successful women. And I wonder, is this seen or understood in terms of gender to the extent that it was? Because certainly we can acknowledge that women in successful positions often, if you scratch the surface, will express self-doubt or a lack of confidence, and they're more likely to express that lack of confidence than their male colleagues.
Yes, that's exactly right, and certainly the early literature in the area was did define it in terms of gender, and that it was a mainly a female issue. Largely, I think that's because the original research was done with groups of women, and so naturally enough, you then begin to assume that. But later research, and certainly my own work in the area, would say that many men also experience it. But I think you're right, is that women are much more likely to talk about it. Mm. Men may experience it, but they will have a different coping strategy, either not talk about it or do something else instead. So that would suggest, I think, that, and explain a little bit of the findings, that women tend to be more represented in it, but generally because they are more willing to talk about it and do something about it.
Yeah, and also, in that situation, also it might have been women who were in roles that they weren't traditionally socially sanctioned to do, so that self-doubt was being felt internally but externally as well.
Well, that's right. I think certainly if you're in a role where maybe there's a gender stereotype and you're the only person, the only woman in that group, or you're from a minority in a particular area, you're going to feel it more intensely then, because not only do you have to look after yourself, but you're probably representing your whole group in that area, and so you'll stand out a little bit more. And so I think people feel it certainly more keenly in areas where it's unusual, or you're maybe the classic one I see is the first person in the family go to university. Mm. And you think, oh, I shouldn't be here, nobody in my family does this. And of course, everybody in your family is saying you're the family genius, you have all these expectations. And that just raises the pressure on everybody then, because if I make a mistake, they'll realise I'm not that clever after all.
Hugh Cairns is my guest this morning. He's co-director of Think Well Consultancy and also based at Flinders University. We're talking about the imposter syndrome, that feeling that you can have when you've actually achieved quite a lot in life. All the evidence suggests you're competent at what you do, but inside you have this nagging self-doubt that somehow you're an imposter, that somehow you're a fraud and you probably shouldn't be there. Let's take some calls. John in Queensland, good morning to you. You think this is actually about being authentic.
You're either authentic or you're not, and that's the question that I think we all have to ask continually in our lives. And if the answer's yes, then you apply the second rule, which I think is two types of business, your business and my business, and what you think of me is none of my business.
Have you had to do that yourself?
All my life, my whole life, and I think that's the art of living, is to find out who we really are, who I really am, and one of the ways to do that is to continually ask that question, am I being authentic?
Mm-hmm. Hugh Cairns, your response to that idea?
Yeah, well, I broadly agree. I think that at the end of the day, it is everybody coming to terms with themselves, and this is who I am, what I can do and what I can't do. But it's easy to say, but it is a lifelong struggle then to try and do it, and often we exist in circumstances that make that hard for us as well. You may have come from a family background that called you to question yourself, or have gone through an education system that constantly either raised expectations or lower expectations. So for some people, it's harder, easier than others to have that what is authentic. And coming to terms with that. So I think it's accurate, but it's still a tough mission to achieve.
Mm. We've got a text message. Thank you very much, John, for the call.
Good morning.
We've got a text message. Oh, my God, imposter syndrome is a permanent state of mind for me throughout my career and more recently in my legal studies. It's completely illogical. I now try to laugh it off. That feeling of being a fraud is what we're talking about today. You might be very competent at what you do, but somehow there's that nagging voice. You don't deserve this. You shouldn't be there. 1300 225 76, or 1300 call RN. You can text us too, 0418 227 6576. And Pete in New South Wales.
Good morning. How are you going?
Very well indeed. You think you've got a family of those who suffer from imposter syndrome?
Oh, half a family, actually. I think the other half are fairly overcooked, maybe even overconfident outwardly anyway. But the other half, I think we've imposterism seems to be the thing that drives us. We've never felt we're quite there yet. And we do the best we can, and, you know, we're all overachievers. You know, we've all gone above and beyond, but still never quite feel like, you know, we're the ones who actually should be there.
What do you think that comes from?
I believe it might be from my father, to be honest. He was a Finnish man and always had the inferior complex about not being, you know, good enough and having to, you know, serve the country that we're actually living in. So Dad always pushed us to believe that, you know, whatever we did, we could always do it better. So we never quite got that moment of absolution, so to speak.
Does it have an impact on you? I mean, you laugh about it, but it actually can really eat away at you, can't you?
Every morning I go to work. I'm a music teacher. I actually play about 200 instruments. I've got an unofficial world record of the most instruments played by one person.
Oh, hello.
And I just don't. I mean, I conduct and I, you know, do musical direct musicals and I perform, and but every single time I go to, you know, the morning of that, I think, can I do this? Can I really play the piano? Can I really sing? Can I play the harp? You know, it's crazy. And I have to actually sit down and listen to myself. Sometimes if I hear a recording of myself, I think it's someone else and I think it's wonderful. But if I hear it as my own, I hear something completely different. So, you know, I've definitely got a different attitude towards myself than I do if I was somebody else. So.
It's a really striking feeling, isn't it? And has anyone in your family had kids? Are you going to pass this trait on to the next generation?
Yeah, I do believe so. I don't actually know my nieces and all my nieces and nephews as well as I'd like to. But the ones I do know, some of them suffer from overconfidence.
There you go. Pete, thanks very much. And that's super impressive. 200 instruments. Appreciate the call. Peter in New South Wales, you actually think that imposter syndrome is linked to the experience of depression. Tell us about what your thoughts are there.
In listening to everyone who's spoken to this point, I think what to me is very recurrent is something that's reality in my life. That is a sense of it not being appropriate for me to achieve certain objectives because I don't feel that I deserve them. I'm certainly not an overachiever. I've always been told that I could be, but it's never been a situation that I felt I warranted or deserved. And the idea of self-doubt, very low self-esteem and self-image, are very characteristic aspects of depression, and I feel what has been spoken about could be classified as depression in many instances.
Yes, I think that's a really potent point you make, that distress around knowing that you could fulfil your full potential, but not being able to.
Well, I don't know that I could. I've been told that I could. Basically and inherently, I don't believe I can. I don't believe I'm an appropriate person to do it.
And does that come from within you, or is it partly being fueled by circumstance?
Well, you're asking what's the cause of depression, I think. Is it a reactive depressive disorder, or is it what they describe as endogenous depression? I think it's maybe a combination. It's within you, but I think a life circumstance can set it off, personally.
Peter, really terrific to hear from you. Thank you for the call.
It's a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Hugh Cairns.
Yeah, just on that, Natasha, but that's one of the strategies in terms of dealing with the imposter syndrome. Some people's strategy is to work super hard and then to overachieve, to be very successful. For others, then, because that fear of doubt, the way to deal with it is to avoid. And so then you don't take some risks, you don't try things, you don't apply for the next job. And then the danger there or the problem then is just have this potential that you'll never know whether it could really have happened or not.
Yeah, and the term imposter syndrome almost makes light of the consequences of this feeling, doesn't it?
For some people it can be very severe, and largely when the links to depression, I think largely I would describe it as a lot of these things are inaccurate thinking or just not very clear thinking through, and so we have views or expectations that aren't borne out by the facts or other evidence, but then we don't come to believe those things, and that influences how we behave, and for some people that leads to anxiety, some depression, a whole range of other factors. For some it's just, you know, it's an inconvenience, it's a worry, it's just a little bit of a drag, but it can become more severe for others.
You and others talk about a fixed mindset. and a growth mindset. Tell us how that those can influence the way we experience this feeling of being an imposter in our own skin.
Well, again, a lot of people want to know where does this come from or how, what's the reason for it. And I think a couple of the models, or one of the models that I think is helpful to understand this is mindset, and that was proposed by Carol Dweck. And her view there is that people either have this fixed mindset, which essentially says we have a fixed amount of intelligence or a fixed amount of ability, you're born that way, and you really can't make a difference no matter what you do. The growth mindset says, no, you can, with effort or with putting in the amount of effort, you can increase your intelligence, you can go and do more things. And whichever one of those you have will influence then how you respond to life a bit later on. And we tend to learn those from the significant people in our lives, generally parents, siblings, teachers at school, and a lot of it will be how you deal with mistakes. If you make a mistake and you're shown that's a really bad thing, that bad consequences, then you learn that's a bit dangerous, and so you don't want to do it again, you want to get everything right or avoid situations. If you're taught that mistakes are a part of learning, and of course we all make them and then you move on, then it makes it much easier. Then you can say this is a process. If I work a bit harder, I can improve along that whole way.
Yes, that seems so key, doesn't it, from the calls that we've received so far too, that our life circumstances, early in life, parenting styles really shapes how we think about our own success and whether or not we feel we have a sense of entitlement to that success.
That's right. And ironically, you'd assume, okay, then we must encourage, we must praise people a lot. And so one of the strategies is to say to your kids, you know, you're clever, how wonderful you did. Ironically, praising sort of fixed abilities like that, saying to somebody, you're clever, you're gifted, actually can increase their stress, because then they go, well, but hang on, what happens if I don't do really well then? If you said I'm really clever and then I come home with a bad report card, suddenly you're going to hate me. So I think the strategy there is you can still praise people, but praise them for their work, their effort, and acknowledge their achievements, but make it clear that even if your grade isn't good, you're still a valuable person.
Well, and it's that thing about praising kids for everything they do, which means that when they really achieve something quite significant, the meaning of that praise is lost in some way. Yeah. From Castlemaine, we've got Paulie. As a visual artist, I always suffered from doubt, feeling not only as an imposter but a self-indulgent self-pleasurer. Then I discovered teaching visual art in my 40s with young children, and I feel I finally discovered my true purpose in life. And on Twitter, Graham writes, of course we feel like fakes, but not because we are. The world around us is the artifice, and in it we are all fish out of water. And I will come back to that point with you, Hugh, but let's take some more calls. Rhiannon in New South Wales. What's the point you'd like to make about this feeling?
I think it takes a lot of courage to really be you when you're up against, you know, social pressures, family pressures, school pressures. And I really like what Hugh said about making mistakes. So you need to step into an environment where you do maybe fake it till you make it while you're building courage, authenticity, belief in self, confidence, so that you become all of who you're meant to be.
Yes, indeed. So it has its place in some sense. I guess the problem is when it always feels like you're faking it.
I don't know if it always feels like you're faking it. I think when you start a new skill, any new skill feels strange. So that might be the faking it part where you know, the first time you do public speaking, you might go, oh my God, I'm going to die. I'm so anxious and nervous. So that might feel like the faking it part. Whereas when you've done it for a few years, you just get up and speak, even though you still feel anxious.
Yeah.
You go, I'm going to feel anxious first and then I love it. So I think it's testing out a new skill set and not being afraid. Like the lady who developed Spanx, her parents, you know, Spanx those underwear.
Yeah, yeah.
Her parents, her dad used to say to her all the time, tell me what mistakes you made this week. And so she went on to build this multi-million dollar company because she wasn't afraid to make mistakes. Like, mistakes was a great thing.
Yeah, that really reinforces the point that Hugh made. Thanks, Rhiannon, very much.
Welcome.
Peter in Victoria, thanks for joining us on Life Matters. You want to talk to the sex differences around this experience?
Yes, I was doing research with Melbourne University students, testing their anxiety levels as part of the research before an exam and after an exam in the actual exam setting. And they showed a dramatic drop in their level of anxiety, both of them, male and female, but the females exhibited their anxiety drops one way and the males a different way. The anxiety test I was using had two types of 10 questions each, direct ones like, I feel anxious, and I'm worried, or indirect ones like I am happy. Now, the females were willing to say, I feel anxious, and then I don't feel so anxious at the end. The males exhibited the same level of change, but by saying, that using the I feel happy one. So in other words, the females were prepared to admit their anxiety change, but the males were not.
Yes, so it's all about how open we are, not just our personal experiences of this. We might all experience this, it's whether or not we talk about it.
Yes, and the females in this sample, which was a few hundred students, were much more willing to exhibit their anxiety change level, but the males were not, even though they actually had the same level of change in anxiety.
Very interesting, Peter. Thank you very much. But of course, what we say about ourselves publicly can affect other people's impression of us, and that's an issue too. Let's take another call from Danny in Victoria. Good morning to you. You think you suffer from the opposite.
Well, I don't know that I suffer from it. Yeah. I'm very pleased to feel
it's
the opposite.
Overused, right? That word, sufferer, I think.
From a very early age, I had a sense that I was pretty special. And I, without a doubt, my mother was primarily responsible for that. And it wasn't about telling me, you're brilliant, you're wonderful, you're everything like that. It was kind of taking notice of me. And I think my father also, I got a sense that he kind of recognised me as being like him in a sense. So that was at a very early age. Through school and so on, I didn't work very hard and I was quite naughty, but I always thought that I would ultimately achieve quite well in spite of the difficulties along the way. And in fact, I did. And I feel very comfortable with being myself and doing what I'm doing. I'm now a barrister and I left school at 16, so... there's been quite a journey along the way, but I've always had this confidence that things would work out well for me.
What a blessing to feel comfortable in your own skin in that way.
There's still work to be done, though. I'm not saying I'm perfect. There's a lot of improvement that can still be made.
Well, that's good to hear. Otherwise, life would be very dull. Thanks, Danny, very much.
Good day. Right.
Hugh Cairns.
Yeah, that's quite the important thing as well, is that, you know, this is a work in progress. There's still work to be done, rather than I'm the finished product. And I suppose that's the whole mindset about, this is okay, I'm doing my best, and I'll move along that whole area. But there's another lovely, interesting psychological construct, which is about, I suppose, the opposite, really. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And they wrote an interesting paper called Unskilled and Unaware. Mm. And basically, they gave tests to people, and what they found was that the less people knew about the material they were working on, the more confident they felt. And so because they didn't know how hard it was, they actually rated themselves quite well. And then the opposite was people who actually were very skilled on the test, they were less confident because they knew how difficult it was. And so that's that idea where you can actually feel confident, but it's not warranted. It's an unwarranted confidence. That's probably the opposite effect.
Yes, indeed. And the other suggestion from research is that with greater success, so can come a greater feeling of that imposter syndrome.
Well, that's right. The higher you go, the illusion imposters have, certainly the ones who work hard, is if I just got one more qualification, one more thing, then I would feel okay, then I would fit in. But ironically, the higher you go, often the worse it can get, because, of course, there's more to be exposed. You know, you get to a new level, suddenly they realise you can't do this at all. And I run a workshop like this at Harvard University. So can you imagine the feeling you'd have as the first day you walked into Harvard? You know, here you are, you're really clever, but suddenly you're going to be surrounded by all these really, really clever people, and you're going to think, I shouldn't be here. So despite having reached that top level, I talked to some students there, and they said Harvard takes its students from the top 10% of colleges in the U.S., and within the first week, 90% of the students have to work out they're not in the top 10% anymore, and that's really hard for them.
Indeed. Just to read a Facebook comment from Jennifer, I only heard this term about 4 years ago. Describe me exactly. Registered nurse, did the old hospital training, turned optometrist and felt I somehow completely fudged my degree, and that any time soon they would find out that I'm not a real optometrist and take away my degree. That feeling has only resolved in the last year or two. Never felt clever enough to go to uni and study science, of all things, and that stuck for a long time. And Alan in New South Wales, good morning to you. You're a musician. You really feel this on stage.
From time to time I do, but the interesting thing is that I read in Paul Kelly's book, How to Make Gravy, that even he and his band at times have this wave of things that come over him. I think he called it the Doubties, I'm not quite sure, where you know, even he'll be up there playing or whatever and suddenly get this feeling that, yeah, he's an imposter and that yeah, he's really not that clever after all. But, you know, on he goes and the band gets over it and away they go and it's all happy days from there.
Yeah, perhaps it's just par for the course as a public performer.
Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe.
Alan, thanks for sharing that story. Hugh.
Pleasure.
I think that there are some areas where it's likely to be more exposed, and anywhere where you're going to put yourself out in public, like, for example, public speaking or doing a performance, there's always going to be that worry, maybe I can't do it this time, maybe they're going to find out. So I think some areas are more prone to it being exposed, or you take more risks when you do that.
Mm. We've had some interesting comments coming in on the SMS. People citing Lacan. Is it about Lacan's theory of misrecognition and the imaginary world we live in? Highly complex and can't be dealt with unless the unconscious is involved. Long, hard work, and someone else is referring to British psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott. I wonder, Hugh Cairns, whether this is also part of, you know, we become grown-ups very fast. I mean, yesterday I feel like I was a teenager. And so it's that sort of feeling within. We've got this sort of continuity from childhood to adulthood. And suddenly we've got to be grown-ups, even though we still feel like the same kid within.
Well, that's right. And I think, again, the places you experience it a lot are in times of transition. You know, you move from high school to university or university into a job or you move from one to another. Those transition points are where you think, but hang on, I can't do this. I'm not really very good at this area or whatever. And often you've gone from something you were confident at. Let's say you were a technical specialist in some job and you get promoted to be the manager. And suddenly you think, but I don't know anything about managing. And you go from being high quality to suddenly not knowing very much at all.
I think that might be your mobile, but I just want to ask one final question if I can. How to manage this? Have you, in your work and in talking to people about this over some years now, and also pulling a book together that I think's out in June, have you come up with some good strategies that people can adopt? Is this about, you know, testing your preconceptions of yourself through things like cognitive behavioural therapy, for example?
Yeah, there's no doubt that that's one of the main ways, because what it is an unrealistic expectation. You expect when you're going to do something for the first time that you're going to be able to do it perfectly. You know, you're going to write a novel, you're going to win the Booker Prize. And so that's cognitive behavior therapy or coaching is saying, well, let's look at the facts here. And, you know, you can write, but you're probably not going to, in your first attempt, do that. So I think that's the one. And one of the strategies I sometimes suggest to people is to keep a fact file. And a fact file is a sheet of paper that says what the evidence really is. Because when you're overcome by the imposter feeling, you're usually at that time not able to draw on the facts. You just can't remember what it is. So writing these things down, and you can say, look, well, hang on, I did get a degree, or I have done these other things, or I have had positive feedback. And that forces you to deal with a little bit more reality rather than that automatic feeling.
Mm.
And so I think it is that fact of looking at the evidence. The other thing that's very important, and I think is, you know, that's why it's good to talk about it, is realizing that you're not the only one, because the problem with it is everyone thinks, I'm the only person who ever feels like this. But then when you hear other people saying the same thing, you realize, it's a more normal thing. So being aware of that is just almost a part of life, that idea of having a little bit of a doubt or a little bit of worry, but then getting on and doing the task.
Yes, and didn't we get some terrific calls about it today? So there we go, opening up the discussion. As we hoped we would achieve. Thank you very much, Hugh Cairns. Really appreciate your time today.
It's my pleasure.
Hugh Cairns is a consultant, a lecturer, a researcher with the Professional Development Unit at Flinders University. Liz has tweeted, "Culture, a culture of achievement and individualism distorts life very different when what we make is attributed to all who have had a hand in it." So thank you very much, and love to hear from you on our Facebook page, and also you can post to our website, or if you'd like to share something more private, you can email from our website to abc.net.au/rn and look for Life Matters. Our listener feedback line, especially if you're in WA, South Australia or Northern Territory and couldn't ring today, 02 833 1430. Really love to hear from you. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning here on RN right across Australia. Life Matters is where you are. A little bit of storytelling coming your way next.